Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Entrepreneur Architect Podcast, episode 39. Welcome back to the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. So this past week, I was on Twitter, like I am every day. I'm on Twitter, and I was checking out the conversations there. And one of the conversations that was going on was among four of my friends, Lee Calisti, Neil Pan, Steve May, and Jeremiah Russell. They were having a conversation about my previous episode, episode 38, about my hardware and equipment at Five Cat Studio. I shared all my equipment and all my hardware here and talked about how I do what I do. And one of the things I mentioned in that episode is how we're running a virtual studio here. We're no longer in the big studio. I have a studio that's all by myself here, and I have my staff remote. And it works out pretty well. And they were having a conversation about virtual studio and had some questions about it. And so what I suggested is I invite them on the podcast, and we have a roundtable discussion about the virtual studio. They can ask me the questions they have. I can answer what I can because it's a relatively new concept for me as well. I'm still learning. I have some growing pains happening, and I'm happy to share what I know and what I'm doing. And so that's what's going to happen tonight. I'm inviting those four guys onto the podcast. I'm hoping that all four of them show up, and we're going to have a little conversation about the virtual studio. So hang in there, and we'll be there right after this. This episode is sponsored by the Entrepreneur Architect Hybrid Proposal. It's the owner-architect agreement that I developed for my own residential architecture firm, Five Cat Studio. It's simple, it's straightforward, easy to understand, and it's very, very client-friendly. Over 100 architects have purchased the Hybrid Proposal video course, where I personally walk you through the proposal package step-by-step, page-by-page. And included with the course is a complete set of document templates, which you may download, modify, and start using for your own projects immediately. If you're interested in learning more about the Entrepreneur Architect Hybrid Proposal, head on over to entrearchitect.com/hybrid. So I have three of my four friends online here. I have Lee Calisti, Jeremiah Russell, and Steve May. Neil Pan is still in the wilds of Canada, and so I guess he could not get a a good signal. So I'm going to hope that maybe he shows up later in our call here. But for now, we have Lee and Jeremiah and Steve. What I'd like to do before we get started is for each of you to introduce yourselves and discuss where you are and what do you do. So let's start with Lee, and then we'll go to Jeremiah and then Steve.
Sure, make me start first. My name is Lee Calisti. I'm an architect in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. That's in the Pittsburgh region of Pennsylvania. I've been an architect since 1991. I've been out of school. I've had my own practice since 2003. And I also teach part-time design studio at Carnegie Mellon University.
And Jeremiah.
My name is Jeremiah Russell. I am an architect, fully licensed architect as of April 2nd of this year.
All right.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Currently practicing in Little Rock, Arkansas. It's kind of the central location of the state. So I pretty much work on projects in all four corners of my state. Arkansas is a fairly small state, so I can do that kind of thing. Originally from upstate New York, got my degree in 2003 from the Savannah College of Art and Design, and have practiced in Florida and Virginia, and now Arkansas, over the last 10 years.
Where in New York?
Upstate, Schenectady.
Yeah, sure. I know it.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, how about you?
Okay, my name is Steve May, also a licensed architect in the state of Illinois. Let's see, I've started in the practice in 1990, became licensed in 1998. Took on a partnership role in the firm at in about 2001, then went out on my own in 2004, and have been there ever since. I'm located in Southern Illinois. A lot of people kind of get confused, think, well, you're from Chicago, right? Because, you know, if you're from Illinois, you're from Chicago, obviously.
Right.
But my office, we're located actually about 5 hours south of Chicago. So we handle, you know, try and handle everything in the, I guess, from the central half down.
And what kind of work do you do, Steve?
Mainly commercial, a little bit of residential, but got my start basically with the first firm. We did probably 90% schoolwork. Whether it was new schools, additions, renovations, whatever it was. But lately I've been doing a lot of banks, hotels, stuff like that.
And you're on your own now?
Yes.
Okay. And Jeremiah, what about you? What kind of work do you do?
Well, during the day, my day job, I work for a larger commercial corporate firm, do a lot of schools. We do some hospitals, office renovations, new office buildings, that sort of thing. My nighttime job, which, you know, is kind of what I'm doing here, I focus mainly on single-family residential as well as light commercial, tenant improvements. My focus is really more on working with clients who will be the end user of the buildings that I'm designing. So not terribly interested in working with board of directors or, school superintendents and that sort of thing with the people who aren't actually going to be using the space. I want to work with end users.
Yep. I did the school work as well for several years, and I left for the same reason. I didn't want to have to sit in school board meetings every day of my life. That's where I was going. So
yeah,
I didn't want to do that. What about you, Lee? Other than teaching, what kind of work what practice are you doing?
Sure. People often get the teaching mistaken. I still have friends that think that I teach full time, and they think I dabble with my practice. But the practice is full time, and the teaching is on the side. But right now, I'm probably split 50-50 with commercial and residential. The commercial work has been a mix of retail, restaurant, things like that. Tend to get into a lot of adaptive reuse projects where we're taking a building that never wanted to be commercial and we're making a commercial, which has been a real challenge, and existing building codes and things. And then the single family residential work has been quite fortunate recently. Some really nice, mostly additions and renovations. New construction has been quite rare, even though some of those have come and a few of those are coming. But and then this past year, I even got into multifamily projects, a few of those. Mm-hmm. But for all of us, I think that the project size is probably limited to a certain size, just because of us being solo practitioners, or some of us being solo practitioners, or at least small firms. This project size is obviously going to be smaller than other practitioners.
Right, and you said things are getting busier.
Things have been very, very busy this year. I've been very fortunate. Like to think that all the efforts of business and marketing are paying off, but I think the economy is also doing well. And but that's been one of the reasons this topic has been interesting to me, is ever since I started my own business in 2003, the idea of working with others, but not in a employee and the responsibilities of an employee situation, has been very fascinating to me. Even one of my former employers and I were talking about virtual offices back in the early 2000s. And I think even Jeremiah and I talked about this over the past couple of years as we've been getting to know each other.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we joke about it, but I think we're both pretty dead serious about it, because we're just curious to see where it's going to go. And I was reading your blog the other day, Mark, and you had something, a casual comment about my staff works remotely. Right. And the irony of that is Jeremiah and Neil and I have been talking online and through social media for a while about this, and had plans to talk this past week about it. So the timing was really nice.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was my podcast, my last episode of my podcast, when I was talking about my equipment and hardware.
Yep.
I had mentioned that that we're working as a remote, you know, a virtual studio with a remote staff. So it's I like it. I don't know if you know the background. I'll give it a brief background of when and how we did what we did. We started in 1999, and we were in a studio for 11 years, about 2,000 square feet. We had six people working at one time, and things, as the economy sort of slowed down, our staff shrunk, and we kept the big studio. And we got to a point this past November where the lease was up, and we were paying about $3,500 a month for 2,000 square feet. And we decided that with the tools that we have available to us, that we were going to make a change and take a big leap and close the big studio. And build a new studio at home for me. Anne Marie, who's my wife, is always, she's my partner as well. She's an architect, and she's always had her own studio at the house. And so now we still have separate studios in different parts of the house. And my staff, who actually, by the time we left, was only one person who was left. He moved to a new office, he rented his own office, and we made him an independent contractor, so he's doing other things as well. And we have a couple of other people working for us as well, who are working remotely, and it's working out pretty well. I like it a lot, actually.
So that's good to know. Are those all independent contractors, or do you have staffed employees that are working remotely?
I no longer have staffed staff employees. Everybody is independent, even the ones that were formerly full-time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still working. He's pretty much doing the same amount of work for us as he was, but he's now doing other work as well.
Right.
And he's working remotely. And so I basically just pay him as an independent contractor. I pay two other people independently. They just and John, who's our former employer or employee, who's still with us. He basically, we talk every day, and he's local, so he'll either stop by or we'll talk on the phone or do email. And then the other guys, I still do a lot of email with them, but all of our files are now on Dropbox, and we're transitioning to Evernote. Evernote is very new, and it's really just me at this point. But once Evernote is set up, all of our project files will be on Evernote as well.
I'm actually using Evernote right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Me too. Actually, I have notes for our conversation here. And I do use Evernote for everything now, which is why I like it.
My Evernote is got yellow pages with blue lines on it.
there you go. And you're not alone. There's a lot of architects still doing that, including my wife.
There you go. So Mark,
This
is Steve. I got a question on, I guess maybe the logistics on a project when you're working with consultants or you know, contract employees like that. When you're doing a commercial or, you know, obviously a project that has to be, you know, done by a licensed architect, how do you handle that as far as them not working directly under you?
Well, they are working directly under me. They're just not working in the same room. Everything I was doing in the big studio, I'm still doing. Other than him sitting right behind me, everything else is the same. I still review the drawings every day. So I'm still going on Dropbox and pulling files and looking what's happening. Instead of the questions coming over my shoulder, they're coming through an email or a telephone call. I believe that eventually we'll have tools, and I think the tools are already out there. They're just not mature enough for us to use them, where we'll have real-time video on our screens of people working somewhere else as if they're in the same room.
I think that's a great question, too. This is something that I ran into recently. There's a small designer down in Florida where I'm also licensed in addition to Arkansas. And they contacted me and needed a licensed architect for a small residential addition. And I said that I would help them and offer them my seal, but that I had to, quote, maintain direct control of the drawings.
Right.
And I got curious about that, so I actually went and looked it up. And I think it's kind of a misnomer in architecture that direct control means they have to physically be there for you to sort of stand over their shoulder and watch them as they draw each line and that sort of thing. And if you read and I imagine every state's different, but Florida, if you read the language, it simply says that at all major milestones, the architect of record must review and approve the drawings before any submissions are made. So there's, as you can imagine, there's a lot of gray area there. But I think the laws were written maybe with the intent that interns and other production staff would be, you know, employed by an architect. But I think the language is such that it allows for today's technology with remote offices, like what we're talking about here today, where, you know, they're not in the same office. Heck, they might not even be in the same country.
Right. Exactly.
You know, but you can still maintain control over the quality of the work that's being done simply through digital files.
Exactly.
I think that's an important distinction to make.
That's obviously been done by branch offices of larger firms for years.
Exactly.
So right. I knew there was some logistics about it, but I assumed it could be done.
Yeah.
Well, I have a person that does contract work for me, and I've had other people do contract work for me. And it has some positive things to it, but the person that does the best contract work for me actually has a full-time job. So the demands I put on him obviously have to be limited, and I have to be more patient. And I'm willing to do that in exchange for the quality of the work and the thoughtfulness that he has. But I would like there to be more people of that caliber available, more available or readily available, so that that work can be done, and maybe all of us can take on more work. And to go back to a good comment Jeremiah was making, I think that's a great point, Jeremiah, that you're making, is theoretically, as the architect, you don't have to draw a single line ever. But what's difficult about reviewing a set of drawings that you've never seen and then asked to put your stamp on that versus being involved from the beginning is you understand the context of every decision that was made and why a certain material was used or why the program is oriented the way it is or why really anything of the building was done the way it was done. You know that because you were involved from the beginning, regardless of whether you drew anything. But when people come to us as licensed architects and want us to put our seal or a stamp on a set of drawings that we've never seen, what I try to explain to them the difference is, even though the assemblies may be common or familiar to us, we don't know how or why certain decisions were made, so it becomes difficult, impossible, or really illegal to make those kinds of decisions. But in the context that Mark's talking about, what is the difference whether he talks to his colleague over the phone or over his shoulder?
Right. And we're still making all the big decisions. We've always done that. You know, Anne Marie does pretty much all of the schematic design. And every step of the way, pretty much on a daily basis, she's working with the people who are doing the work to make sure it's being done the way she expects it to be done. So nothing's really changed at all.
Yeah, I mean, well, anybody on the, like you said, with Dropbox, you know, they're, it's just as easy as being in the next room right. as opposed to the next state.
Yeah, and, you know, in Anne Marie's situation, nothing has changed for her because she always has had her own studio at the house, and the staff has always been in the big studio. So she's always worked remotely since we started the firm.
Oh, that's interesting.
Instead of Dropbox, I would just, you know, I would be the courier. You know, I would bring the drawings home and she would have them the next day, and then she would call the staff and work with them over the phone or through email.
What I like about Dropbox, and I guess it's becoming archaic to some of these newer apps, is instantaneous updating of the files. I know when other contract help is working right. on my projects because I can see the window in the bottom of my screen where they've saved it, and it uploads to Dropbox and then downloads to my machine, so I can look at it instantly. That in and of itself is pretty cool.
Yeah, I get instant notification as soon as it's updated. A little bubble pops up on my screen, and I see that. And so I could also keep track of who's working and when they're working.
Right.
Because you can see as they're updating, it's coming up. And all our drawings, we're no longer using a local server. We're backing up Dropbox, but all our drawings are on Dropbox, and we're working directly on Dropbox as if we were working on our local server. We're no longer downloading them, working on them, and then back uploading them again. We're working on
that was kind of one question I had when you mentioned that was, how is that working fairly well with you know, just uploading and working from Dropbox?
That's
something I haven't done yet.
For us, there's been no difference at all. I mean, I have a relatively new iMac, and so it's pretty powerful, and I have a direct internet connection. I'm not using wireless. But I see no difference because I do have my server still hooked up, and if I'm pulling files off the server or if I'm pulling files off Dropbox, I can't tell the difference.
Okay,
that's just, I haven't tried that before either, but that's awesome.
Yeah, I would say some of the negatives of what we're doing is probably the biggest one is that I'm in this room all by myself again. When we started, I was in a room all by myself, and now I'm all by myself again, which at times I really like. I'm sort of that kind of person that likes to be alone. But, you know, I enjoyed the camaraderie, and even more than the camaraderie, I liked being able to turn my chair around and bounce something off of John, and or him to have a question, can just instantly ask me the question rather than waiting or typing an email or doing something else. So that instant connection and that personal bond that you have with somebody who's in the same room, and the sort of the spontaneity of design, where, you know, if you're walking past and you see something that somebody's working on, you have this conversation and something happens in that design and it becomes even better. Those little surprises that once happened in the big studio no longer happen, because now things aren't happening at the same time. As technology catches up with what we're doing, I think a lot of that working at the same time on a screen will happen again, but it'll happen in a different way.
Well, I look forward to that. That kind of raises a question that if I can ask Mark related to this, and I'm asking this from a point of view where I've had two, maybe three people do contract work for me, and like I said, one person has done it on an ongoing basis for me. One person did it for a period of time with me. So there's a project that exists, and somebody gets that project. Somebody's the lead, so to speak. Someone came and hired Steve or Jeremiah or whatever to do this project, okay, or me, yeah, or you, yeah, okay. And then say all of us, the four of us, five of us with Neil or whoever else we invite to the party, are going to collaborate. We use that word, collaborate. And this was a blog post that I never finished. How do we divide up the tasks and responsibilities in a way that isn't that still has respect and a level of teamwork?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, for us, we our responsibilities and our roles haven't changed. So Anne-Marie is still the lead on the design, and our staff is production. And he collaborates with Anne-Marie, but he's still production. And I run the business and I work with clients. And I still oversee the projects and make sure that I put my input, but I don't do a lot of design. What you're talking about is something very different, where you're collaborating with other professionals and sort of doing joint ventures. My guess is what would happen is that whoever got the job in the first place would be the lead and the other people would be collaborators. And that whoever is the lead is the final say. I think a lot of that is going to be the personality of the people working on the projects. You'll have to sort of figure out who does what and how far you can push somebody to do what you want them to do if you're really the lead person. I think that'll be some ground rules that you'll have to establish before you start, so everybody understands who's in charge and what the roles are for each person.
Yeah, I actually have a little bit of experience with this from the firm that I worked for immediately previous to the one that I'm currently with. Fairly large project came along that we teamed up with another firm on the RFP. It's a large health science building for a local community college here in Arkansas. And the firm I worked for was the lead architect and project architect and was responsible for signing and sealing all that. And the firm that we partnered with was really more responsible for helping with schematic planning and programming, and then later on down the road in construction documents. And sitting in on the meetings, my previous firm, it was just myself and the principal of the firm, so I was pretty hands-on with just about everything. And it became clear very, very early that we had to very clearly define exactly whose role was what, because as you can imagine, you get five architects in a room around a set of drawings and everybody wants to be the lead architect.
Yeah.
and I mean everybody. there was one or two meetings where it was, you know, things even started to get heated. And I think it was after one of those meetings where my boss and I got back to the office and he sat down immediately and literally typed out a list of, you know, everybody's name in each firm and exactly what their role and responsibility was, and sent that out to everybody and just sort of, you know, laid it out, said, this is the part you're responsible for. This is your box, get inside and let's all move forward. And Mark, I think what you said is right. You know, it's I don't think there's a one solution for every project. I think each project is going to be a little bit different. You just sort of have to figure it out. But whoever you do invite on projects, and especially in this sort of, you know, network of professionals that we're talking about here, you got to start by building relationships and building a foundation of respect and admiration for each other, so that when it does come time to share work, we can all be very clear, very open, honest, and upfront about exactly what it is that we each need for whatever particular project that it is. And I think, you know, that just comes out of, like I said, just having a respect for each other and just wanting to do good work rather than wanting to get our name on something.
Well, Jeremiah, after that memo and that list and that matrix came out, how did the tone and the morale and the responsibilities pan out from there? Did everybody just go back to their corner and accept that, or was there
tension? I don't think they went back to their corner. I think there was actually a new level of sort of calm on the project because because there was that sort of definition. You know, before that, everybody was sort of trying to kind of take control of certain pieces and parts, you know, whatever they sort of latched on as part of the project that they really felt strongly about. And once my boss sort of just said, no, look, this is how the project's going to be organized. This is how we need to work it in order to get the work done so that we can all be proud of this project at the end. I think that was sort of had a sobering effect on everybody. And they were like, you know what? He's right. You know, I need to let go of whatever emotional attachment I've got to, you know, this stair detail and, you know, concentrate on what's really important over here, you know, my set of tasks. Because at the end of the day, you know, we did all have our name on that project. And, you know, we can all collectively be proud of it because it's going to turn out well in construction because we all did our parts. You know, we didn't all have to be in control. We just had to be in control of ourselves and do, you know, play the role that we were assigned on that particular project. And incidentally, my old firm and the firm we partnered with, they are now one firm.
Oh, so
yeah,
this
interesting.
This even became an actual partnership where my boss went in as a senior associate to that firm and they have now merged and become one. Hmm.
I would say in
now they're a bigger beast.
In a similar vein, I would also suggest that if I was working with another professional that was at the same level as I was, because we're really talking about two different things. We're, you know, for me, it's a studio, and I have different levels of people. Where you guys are talking about, you're collaborating everybody at the same level. I would say that if you're collaborating and you're creating these little joint ventures that are not permanent, I would suggest that you put all that in writing, that the respect and the personalities and the relationships are very important to build those. But I think even on top of those good relationships, there should be some sort of written agreement that describes the project and who's responsible for what and the roles needed and who will be in charge of each role. And so as the project goes, not only will it have some structure and allow you to do the things that Jeremiah is talking about, but if something does go wrong and there is a conflict, you have something to go back to refer and say, okay, here's how we're going to do this. Because even the agreement should even have conflict resolution and how are we going to deal with this? Just as if you were working with a client, I would suggest that you still, put some sort of, even if it's just a letter of agreement, put something together so that everybody's on the same page, and then put it away, and you don't have to ever worry about it unless you need it.
Yeah, and Mark, I think we're probably using the term collaboration a little loosely in this
right.
sense. I think what Lee and Neil and I have talked about in the past is really more of a situation like what you have, where you have independent contractors who provide production help for your studio.
Right.
And while, you know, joint ventures would be great. And I've talked about that a little bit in that, as we create this network of like-minded architects that have different skill sets and different areas of expertise that may be valuable in my local market on, you know, maybe some larger projects that I probably wouldn't be able to get on my own. But if I partnered with, say, Lee, or, you know, even with you, if, you know, background in school or whatever, then that would be more of a joint venture type thing where yes, we have to have those, you know, that contract and those clearly defined roles and responsibilities. But I think, you know, in that collaborative effort, we're really talking more about having a network of people available, like Lee said earlier, to pull from for production help.
Right.
You know, when things get, you know, when the workload gets a little bit too heavy, and perhaps, you know, we don't want to have to say no to a project that comes in the door, but maybe we don't have, you know, we don't have the time in our own schedule to take care of it. But, you know, if we have this network available, we say, oh, well, you know what? I know that Lee and Steve, they've got some time available. They can help me out. So I can take this project on.
Right.
And they can help me sort of spread the workload out a little bit.
Yeah. And that's similar to what I'm doing as well. As we grow, I'm building this network of people that when I need them, I can take them on. And when I don't, they're working somewhere else, doing something else.
Right.
Well, and if they have a regular, if they get a fairly regular amount of work from you, Mark, and you communicate about that frequently, then that helps them make decisions about other projects elsewhere. That doesn't mean they're not responsible for themselves. You're not responsible to feed them like an employee.
Right.
But it's no different for, say, a general contractor and a plumber.
Right.
A particular plumber may do exclusive work for a certain general contractor because that general contractor gives them project after project. But what I want to add to Jeremiah's comment is, in my case, where I would want others to collaborate with me is not and not be thought of in a menial, unimportant role, but in a very, very important role, because as a solo practitioner, I have to do everything. And Jeremiah's doing everything at night. And Steve, I'm not sure exactly what you're doing, but I'm sure you probably do everything too. So if someone was going to collaborate with me on a project at whatever level they were at, especially if they were at a higher level with us, all of us being licensed, I would probably give very little direction and say, run with it, because I trust your experience to be able to figure some things out that I would have to normally explain to someone with less experience.
Right.
Well, in that same aspect, you've probably collaborated with that person because they have experience in that. So at the same time, you can trust them in that direction.
Right. So I would be showing the utmost of respect. From my point of view, from my thoughts, I would be showing the utmost of respect by allowing this person, this other architect, to have a really long leash at developing this project.
And I know this, Steve, and I know you guys have done a lot of talking before I kind of, you know, when it's brought into this, you know, this group here. But kind of what I see out of the collaboration is you know, we've touched on a lot of different aspects here, but you know, not only is it a good direction for a contract person to help out with as sole practitioners with help for when, you know, we've got a lot of work and there's, you know, we need help to get things done, but in the same aspect, I do a lot of mine, I get a lot of my work from you know, RFPs or, you know, and by utilizing your guys' expertise and maybe something that I'm not as familiar with that will help in getting a project. And I see that as a big thing on my side in the collaboration is in help, you know, say, let's sit down and say, okay, you know, I'm going to be 60%, you're going to be 40%. And we're going to collaborate on this and maybe not necessarily a joint venture, but, and I don't know, maybe the logistics of how a resume would be laid out, but or on the RFP, how a separate person would be listed. You wouldn't necessarily put them as an employee, but that's something that we'd probably just have to work out.
Yeah, and there's a ton of different contract structures out there that deal with those sorts of things. I think the AIA actually has a joint venture sample contract out there, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
They've got a contract for everything.
Yeah.
That's true. You know, one of the things I did on EntreeArchitect.com when I first relaunched it a couple of years ago, a few months after I relaunched, I had a thing called EntreeArchitect Projects. And it was a way for people in your situation where you had too much work and you were looking for help to post a project and then have other architects submit proposals to help you do that work. So it was a way to kind of find those people that you were looking for. And it didn't work very well. And I don't know if it's because I didn't promote it very well or the concept wasn't clear. But I after about a month and a half or so of trying it, maybe 2 months, I sort of slowly pulled it offline and made it go away. But I could imagine that as this idea of virtual studios matures, because I've said this before, I believe it's the future of small firm architects. I think that they'll still be the traditional firm, but I think that eventually there'll be more virtual studios than there will be the real studios. And I think we'll have a need for those networks to help build relationships. And I think my Entree Architect Academy, which is going to launch in September, I think a lot of those relationships will happen there as well, because we're planning to do video conferencing and all other kinds of things where the people who are in that group will start to create some pretty strong, solid relationships, and similar things that happened with you guys, where through Twitter, you've built relationships. So anybody that says Twitter is a waste of time is crazy, because here's a perfect example of why you should be on Twitter. But I think that it'll happen in other networks as well. And the opportunities will be there.
Yep. Yeah. And I think this sort of, networking and remote studio model that we're talking about here, it's also important to get out and build those same relationships with other local architects. I mean, one of the things that I've been trying to do is, since I got my license and decided that, it's really time for me to get out on my own, is I don't necessarily want to always be competing with my peers. I'd much rather work with them than work against them. So one of the things that I've been doing a lot in the last couple of months, even as I've kind of paralleled, this whole discussion with Lee and with Neil and now with you, Mark and Steve, is getting out and meeting other local architects, sole practitioners that that do similar work, but also do other kinds of work as well, to try to build these same sorts of relationships so that even locally I can hopefully have a resource and be a resource for these other architects to be able to share work, in more of a collaborative, cooperative effort rather than a competitive one.
I think that's a very good point, Jeremiah, because that's actually the next step for me is to find another person local, because there are certain responsibilities in what we do that they need to be local. You know, construction administration can't be done remotely.
Sure.
Somebody needs to be on site. And so I'm looking for somebody who can be another project manager like John, and can take on a role like John where he does construction documents and then does a lot of the CA work. And so that needs to be somebody local. And so I'm looking for that's probably going to be my next connection.
And do you still see that as a contract employee, or is that somebody?
I still would be independent contractor and would be working remotely just like John.
Jeremiah, have you been out and talked with other local architects yet, or is this just something you're looking at doing?
No, I have.
And how has that worked? I mean, I know in my area, it seems like it's tough.
Yeah. It's really not that different here. Arkansas is a very interesting state. It's a very small state. And so even, you know, like I said, I've worked on projects in all four corners of the state. I can drive 3.5 hours and be in Oklahoma in any direction. I can be in Oklahoma. I can be in Missouri, you know, Mississippi, Tennessee, yeah. Texas, it's a small area. And so, the talent that I have access to is really includes the entire state. And Arkansas, just as a culture on the surface, is very friendly, but just like where I came from in Florida, the architecture community is just cutthroat. It's not friendly. We all get together for the state convention every year, and we smile and we drink and, you know, have a good time, and everybody talks about all the wonderful, great, shiny new projects that they're working on. And there's this camaraderie for, 48 hours. And then as soon as we're back in our hometown, it's back to business as usual, trying to cut the legs out from under the other guy. And so, I think no matter where I think that's just an architectural culture, and it's incredibly unfortunate.
I agree.
So I am combating against that, and it's a little slow, but it's a process. I think sole practitioners like us are naturally more open to the idea of cooperation instead of competition, just because, like you said, Lee, we're doing it all. So
right.
I mean, without help, there's only so far we can go before we jump out the first floor window. And so without kind of reaching out to our peers and to our competition, we're either going to stay very small and sort of get by, or we're going to burn out and we're going to become, theater designers or security guards or something.
Well, I think the other thing that it can do is I think it can allow more clients to have access to architects, and more of us will be doing more of that. And that has been an ongoing conversation with people like Greg Larvedera and all kinds of other of our friends out there that just constantly saying, why aren't we doing more? Why aren't we doing more of those projects? Why are those people going to non-architects? And I'm not trying to pick on non-architects. I'm just saying that we may be able to pick up more work because we can back and forth with each other.
Yes, correct. Right.
And then everybody benefits then if we believe our mantra.
Yep. And that is the hope. Lee, I know I've heard you talk several times about, how do you field projects? How do you say yes? How do you say no? I think you've even said here that, if you had a sort of a larger network to pull from for production work, you would be able to say yes much more often.
That's true. And I'm still working on that blog post, Mark, about how to take on projects, how to turn down projects.
Yeah.
I've been very choosy in the past year, but I probably would have taken on a few more of those, Jeremiah, if I had somebody not just to do what some people think is menial work but just to run with a project and say, here, have at it.
Yeah.
Put all your heart and soul in it and your creativity, and I'll oversee it, and it'll be my name, so I'll take the heat for it.
Right.
But I'll give you a long leash to think and to contribute your skills and your intellect and your design prowess, and as well as your technical ability to put together CDs.
Lee, don't do that. Just call me and send it to me.
All right, Steve.
So I want
to. It's been a slow year. I'm sorry.
Well, that's why we're having this conversation, Steve. Is exactly we can build right. these if we can build these relationships. I worked with a woman in Kentucky, and I never, to be honest with you, I've never met her in person, and it worked. I mean, yeah. we there's some bugs to work out. She's a fellow Vectorworks user. But the distance doesn't matter, Steve.
No.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really what we're talking about. So whether it's with these guys, Steve, or anybody else, if you let people know that you're available to help, you may be surprised at how many people reach out to you for that help. Because regions like me, New York, I'm right outside of New York City, I'm turning work away. And so we have more work than we can handle. And the other architects in the region are similar. So there's a lot of work out there. It's just in different regions.
I've turned down quite a bit. I don't like to do that. But there have been many reasons why, but maybe I would have said yes to one or two.
Yeah. So we're at 46 minutes here, so I think we need to wrap up. But I think this has been a fantastic conversation. I think it's just the beginning, so I think we can probably continue the conversation on Twitter or over at LinkedIn at the Entrepreneur Architect LinkedIn group. And I want to thank you, Jeremiah, and Lee and Steve for coming by. I did get a little green note from Neil while we were talking. He apologizes for missing out, but he wasn't able to connect, and wishes he was with us, but he couldn't be with us. So we missed you, Neil. We wish you were here, but we'll do it another time. So I appreciate your time, guys. Thanks for being with me.
Great. Thanks,
Mark. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. You're welcome. We'll see you over on Twitter.
Sure thing.
Have a good night.
Cheers.
So before I head out here, I just want to share some Twitter handles with you guys. Lee Calisti can be found at Lee Calisti. So it's at Lee, L-E-E. Calisti is C-A-L-I-S-T-I. Jeremiah is R1 Studio Arch. So it's R-O-N-E Studio Arch. Steve May can be found at Steve May RK Tech. So it's Steve May, M-A-Y, letter R, letter K, T-E-C-T. And the one and only, the infamous Neil Pan is at NPAN, N-P-A-N-N, two N's at the end of Neil Pan. So check us all out at Twitter. If you want to connect with me, I am at Entre Architect, and I am Mark R. LePage, and I am an Entrepreneur Architect. Thanks for listening.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.